In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby.
It's time for us to talk movies. Alan Adams joining us right here in studio. How are you, Mr. Adams?
I'm well, thanks. Yourself?
I'm good. I assume the only reason you're not in shorts is because you just came from work.
That's right. I was definitely at work, and I've not been there quite long enough to start pushing that particular envelope. But believe you me, if I could figure out a way to finagle a day or two a week in shorts come summertime, I'm going to definitely take advantage.
Must have been nice on campus today.
Yeah, no, it was lovely. One of those things where I actually reached out midday and to Sheridan, and was like, "Do you have 15 minutes? Like, let's just go for a walk." And it was nice. Like, it was a lovely day. As you were saying, maybe a little breezy at times, but that's okay. And I mean, it is still March, so.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was nice to just get out and stretch my legs and get some fresh air. And like you could tell, like, spring is springing. Like, the students are getting antsy. Yes, I imagine it's, if anything, it's probably a little worse over there at in the high school, because they're just looking out the windows and seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, as they say.
Yeah, of course, the difference is with the high schoolers. I mean, they got to wait till June,
right?
College students, they can smell it in the air.
Oh my God, yeah, it's like 6 weeks away.
Yeah,
and particularly for the graduating students, just like, yep. But you just want to be like, keep your heads down. Like, I know it seems like it's tomorrow, but there's a lot of time between now and then. You got some stuff to do.
Major League Baseball opens this week. You ready for some baseball?
I am. Although, I'm watching my fantasy baseball lineup slowly get riddled by demotions.
Oh dear.
Well, cause, I hadn't heard about, Bobby Dalbec getting sent down until Volpe,
yeah,
the kid made the team from New York, so that meant my guy Oswald Peraza got sent down, so I'm gonna have a couple of
some holes to fill,
a couple of blank spots in the old lineup, at least initially, it's one reminder of the potential downsides of the I'll just pick minor leaguers for my bench. Like, I have my starting lineup is full of guys who'll play. It'll be fine. And as it turns out, maybe not so much.
Well,
maybe
you haven't lost any guys to injury yet, though, as other folks in the league have.
That's true.
Seen some big talent go down.
That's true.
Jose Altuve's of the world.
Yeah, and I've got plenty of time. I figure Jacob DeGrom will get maybe 15, 16 pitches in before something twangs,
right.
and he's out till the All-Star break.
Right.
I'm just stoked that, we're going to have some games that count here in a second. Like, it's always really, a really wonderful time of year. It's going to be the first opening day in a while where I'm actually going to have to be somewhere. So,
that's no good.
Right. I'll figure something out, even if it's just listening to, Castiglione on the radio while I'm doing stuff. Like, it'll be good. But, other than that, I should probably mention this. We've talked before about the Port Fringe Theater Festival's annual pop-up fundraiser.
Yes, yes.
That is this coming weekend. It is for those who are familiar with the term, it follows the exquisite corpse model, in which an existing work in the public domain is chopped up and distributed to a number of groups or individuals. Each group or individual gets their own section, and they are tasked with bringing that section to life in whatever way they see fit, as long as they use at least one line of original text, keep it to 5 minutes or under, and continue telling the story. Everything else is fair game. This year's offering is The Great Gatsby.
Oh, nice.
And this will be my sixth pop-up, Man, it's just fun. Like, it's a chance to just it's a low stress, low stakes way to just get weird, sort of embrace the strangeness. I don't necessarily get the opportunity to do that as often as I'd like. And so so I'm taking full advantage. That show is Saturday night at Maine Media Works, I believe is the name of the venue, down in Portland. Yeah, it's going to be a really good time.
Finally, you get to dress like Daisy Buchanan.
Oh, man. I got fringe everywhere. I got one of those little headbands and gams for days.
Oh, no question about that. Yeah, I don't know if you heard this because it would normally be Downtown Madness season, but we're resting, we're pausing, we're maybe just putting it away forever after 10 years. But instead, beginning next week, voting for the first class of the Downtown Hall of Fame.
Like, look, I heard, and I didn't want to be like, but all you people out there, I don't have to be Babe Ruth or Ty Cobb, but you know, I'm fine with Honus Wagner.
Yes,
I'm fine with Christy Mathewson. Like,
but you've been here since day one.
But I mean, it just feels. It feels like something like, and I'll campaign if I have to.
If you're not in the Hall of Fame, I don't know if we can call it a legitimate Hall of Fame.
Well, I mean, you know, as long as I'm on the outside looking in, we're in a Hall of Very Good situation. because let's be real, when it comes to downtown, they don't come much more famous than me.
Well, there you go. There you go. Right there. All right. Boom.
But yes, no, I'd be lying if I said I didn't want it. Because I do.
Well, yeah.
I do want it.
And we want a nice big class where, you know, we're doing it kind of like the Sports Hall of Fames do. So anybody who gets 50% on the preliminary ballot makes it to the final ballot, and then 75% after
those,
that.
I think those numbers are appropriate.
Yes. Yeah. But, you know, I'm hoping the first class will be, you know, dozen plus, which would be good because it's a lot of different areas that we encompass.
Well, and it's just, I mean, there's just, like, you're drawing from such a large pool, you know? Like, I mean, the numbers are I'm sure staggering.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll later this year we'll hit 3,000 shows and 20,000 interviews.
That's a lot.
Psh, crazy.
It's a lot.
And you know, how many thousands of those are you?
a not insignificant percentage.
No.
I'm involved with, for sure.
Well, I mean, an average of, you know, couple times a week for 10 plus years, that's a lot.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm guessing, like, I feel pretty confident even with, you know, time, you know, removed for various, you know, things. I'm going to say, I'd feel comfortable saying my number's got a comma in it.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well over 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Man. All right. Well, let's talk movies. That's also why you're here today. And we've got a couple, can't wait to hear about. Shall we start with, John Wick 4 and see where that's going?
Yeah, let's talk about that. It's really interesting to watch a movie like this because I've been a big fan of this franchise from before it was really a franchise, because the original John Wick movie was one of those films, and they've The first one was very much like, how do I put this? Open-ended, but in a way in which it actually did have an ending, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
As opposed to the to-be-continued vibe that so many of these franchises have, where it's like, you go in knowing there's going to be another one. So it's almost like, you know, you're just along for the ride. And with this film, with these films, I have to say there's something really remarkable about the combination, the sort of confluence of circumstances that came together to generate these movies, because you have, the action sequences are fantastic, like from beginning to end, like from the first movie, from the opening moments of the first movie to the climactic stuff happening in Chapter 4. Like, the action sequences are on point, make sense. Chad Stahelski, the director, was a longtime stunt coordinator before he moved into this position behind the camera. His relationship with Keanu Reeves goes all the way back to The Matrix. So it's this wonderful connection between filmmaker and star. So you have that. But the thing about these movies, and the reason that I think they sort of transcend like the your basic like gun-fu, like shoot 'em up type movies, is the world building that goes into it. Because what they've done is they've sort of allowed organically, in a lot of ways, this entire sort of rich world to sort of be created as a foundation underneath the way this character operates. And so, yeah, you can go, like, if you're someone who just likes to see, you know, guns being shot and fist fights and sword fights and car chases, like, you're going to have a good time in these movies. But if you want a little something more, that's here too, because you have these, you know, all this complex mythology layer upon layer, and really talented actors delivering that material to you. Whether we're talking about, you know, Ian McShane has been a part of the franchise since the beginning. The late Lance Reddick, who's so wonderful in these films. There's a Bill Skarsgård shows up in this new film as a new character. And we've seen wonderful performers in past films as well. And it's just this great sort of collection of just fascinating stuff jammed into this blockbuster package. And the reality is, like, this franchise could go on forever, and it could stop after this film. Like, they've really done a wonderful job of sort of constructing things, so they've left themselves with a lot of options in whichever way they want to take it. I'm not going to go too deep. Because John Wick 4, it's a pretty plotty movie, and I don't want to get too far into the weeds as far as that's concerned, simply because, once I start, like, I'm going to have to keep going, and that can get a little complicated. But the basic gist is our man John Wick, played by Keanu Reeves, is still on the outs with the mysterious collection of powerful underworld types known as the High Table. He has been targeted by a new figure known as the Marquis. That's Skarsgård's character, who has been given carte blanche by the powers that be to do anything and everything necessary to remove John Wick from the equation. And that's kind of like that. That's about all you need to know, really. He still has his relationships with the manager, Winston. That's Ian McShane, who's just, he's so good in these movies. Lance Reddick is here, as I mentioned. We meet a few new characters as well, and as well as sort of touching base with some of our past favorites. But really, that's the basic gist. And we just see as our man John Wick basically fights his way through in an effort to finally remove himself from the influence of these mysterious powers that be, and to get there, he goes all over the world, at one point he's chasing dudes across the desert on a horse. And then he's in New York City. And then he's in the sewers hanging out with Lawrence Fishburne, who's the king of the underworld, like the hobo king, whatever you want to call him. And then it's off to Berlin and just these wonderful sort of set pieces all. The incredible part about this movie is how just stuffed it is, but you never really lose the thread. It's one of those things, and it's kind of crazy to say. I do think someone could go into this movie having never seen any of the other films and have a good time. There'd be some moments of confusion because there is a pretty dense mythology built up around the film at this point. But in terms of just kinetic storytelling, like, it's really strong. And, you know, taking into account the fact this film's almost 3 hours long.
Wow.
Like, it's long.
Wow.
But it never feels like, you don't feel that length in the way that you do with some of the more self-indulgent films. And I do include, breaks my heart to say it, some of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, some of the DC films, they tend to get weighed down a little bit in their own sort of self-seriousness. This movie, it's just so full of energy that it's like you never feel like you're getting bogged down, even though it is, as I said, like very plotty. But the story and the set pieces are really simpatico in a way that you don't necessarily always see in action movies. And so obviously that sort of contributes to the overall success, both of this film on its own and the franchise writ large. As I alluded to, this movie ends in a way that I was not expecting. I would not be surprised if this marks the end of the franchise, but I also would not be surprised if this serves as a full reinvigoration of the franchise. Like it could, like they've really done a great job of just keeping their options open while also delivering a degree of closure on the story that they were telling with this individual film.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting to me because I've come full circle on Keanu Reeves. I was not a big fan.
Yeah.
But John Wick made me a fan because he was so good, so unexpectedly good, and because of the story. And to me, that's what separates these from a lot of these action films that there's always, it's not, story is just going to get us to the next shoot 'em up. No, there's actual story, and it's almost like the action sequences are the icing on the cake rather than the meat.
Yeah, it's crazy that they're able to do that because they clearly build these movies around these set pieces, and yet you've got this wonderfully complex world where, like, at any given moment, like, you can look in the background or like there's an interstitial scene or whatever that just gives you this little tidbit of extra information where you're just like, where it's just, there's an immersiveness to us. There's a fullness to the world that they've made that you just don't see, not just in this kind of movie, but like, I think in mainstream filmmaking writ large at this point, like, which sounds crazy to say, but it's really a remarkable bit of, you know, it is a fully realized universe in a way. You know, they've done in four movies what I mean, like, I don't know that we've got the same depth of world in much larger franchises, like, and they've done it in four films. Like, it's a wonderfully accomplished bit of filmmaking. And like you mentioned, with Keanu Reeves, like, this is such a phenomenal part for him. Like, and he's, you know, he really, it's one that plays up to his strengths, and their strengths that maybe we didn't necessarily give him credit for 20 years ago. Yeah. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I'll cop to that too. I was kind of the same way. And I ride hard for, you know, the Bill and Ted movies and all that stuff. But I mean, but the truth is there was a stretch there where it was like, oh yeah, no, Keanu Reeves is a bad actor. And he's not. And no. I don't think he ever has been. No. I think it's just one of those things where he only later in his career was he like consistently put in a position to succeed. And you know, when you find those moments and you find those roles, like, there's this wonderful blossoming that happens. And I feel like he's someone who has really benefited from finding his people. You know, when it comes to, you know, making movies, like he's really developed a wonderful creative partnership with Stahelski and the other folks who are behind these movies. So we'll see what happens. Like, I know there's been talk of like sort of John Wick adjacent like television series. There was one that was supposed to focus on the hotel called The Continental. I think that fell by the wayside. There was also one that was intended to focus on the ballet school / assassin school that Angelica Houston ran in the last movie. Like, there was talk about that being its own series. I don't know where that project is in development, but that's the thing. Like, the fact that they can just sort of toss off these ideas and just be like, oh yeah, that would totally work. Yeah, that would absolutely work too. That speaks, that's really a testament to the scope and the detail that's gone into creating the world that these movies exist in.
Excellent. All right. That's the word on John Wick 4. I did not even know about this documentary until you tweeted about it earlier.
Yeah, like it was a surprise to me. Like, I saw it by accident when I was just flipping through looking for something to watch the middle of last week. It was like, you know, coming Friday, and from the nose up, the big glasses, and it's just Reggie. And I'm like, oh, really? And so I obviously was like, well, I'm, I mean, I, as a huge baseball fan, particularly of baseball history, like I was obviously gonna check this out. It's pretty great, Rich. It's a really sort of wonderful snapshot of who Reggie Jackson is today.
We get
a lot of perspective as to how we got to this place. But it spends a lot of time with him talking about basically like his place in the larger black athlete culture from the 1960s and 70s. Hmm. There's a lot of conversation with him, but we also get to see him talking with his old teammates. Like there's, you know, like he and Raleigh Fingers and Joe Rudy, Dave Duncan, like those dudes all still hang out. Like wow. They're all still friends.
That's great.
You know what I mean? Like, yeah. And there's a great sequence where he's sitting in the stands in the Coliseum, and it's Vida Blue and Dave Stewart and Reggie Jackson.
Wow.
So we have all these talking head stuff. And then like we see him engaging with other like sort of his athletic peers. Like there's an extended sequence with him and Dr. J. Like the two of them are apparently very, very close. The film actually opens, or basically opens, with Reggie on the phone, with Pete Rose. And cause Pete Rose is like, are you coming this year? And he's talking about Cooperstown. Like, and he's like, I don't know. Like it's, you know, I'm traveling so far. And Pete Rose is like, well, where are you coming from? He's like, California. And Pete Rose is like, well, I'm coming from effing Las Vegas. A lot of Fs coming out of Pete Rose,
which is
hysterical. But that's like one of the first things you see. And it's just like, and then you hit the ground running. And so this is a guy, we get to watch him sort of like have a conversation talking about the complexity of his legacy. And it is a complicated one, you know? We get to hear him talk about his time in the minor leagues when he, you know, like his first minor league assignment was Birmingham, Alabama, in the early 1960s.
Yeah.
Like that's tough. That's a tough go for a black man, at that time, you know, but that is when he first connected with your Raleigh Fingers, your Joe Rudy, like those guys all came up together, which is something I don't think I knew. I assumed because they all sort of came of age kind of at the same time. It makes sense, but
right.
I hadn't really thought about them being on the same team in the minor leagues. But then we get to the early Oakland years, where he's the good soldier for a couple of years, and then, you know, he leads the league in homers, tries to get a raise. Charlie Finley, notorious cheapskate that he was, the owner of the A's at the time, really pushed back hard. And I think in a lot of ways that first salary dispute with Charlie Finley, I think radicalized Reggie in a lot of ways. To the point where he's like, okay, so if this is how it is, then this is how it is.
Yeah.
And we're going to, like, if that's how you're going to treat me, if you can't treat me like a man, I'm not going to treat you like a man. Like, the respect is a two-way street. And so I think that attitude informed a lot of the rest of his career from the rest of his time with the A's when they won the three titles in the row to when he joined so many others in the mid 70s after the reserve clause was finally struck down and was able to sign. He signed with the Yankees. Some great archival footage of George Steinbrenner, which is one of those things where I'm like, man, I forgot about George. One of those things where it's like, honestly, like in my head, he had in a lot of ways become conflated with Larry David on Seinfeld.
Right,
and
right.
So seeing him like in the flesh, like talking and like and engaging in that way, it was just like, oh, right, the boss, I remember.
Yeah. And Billy Martin and Reggie.
Oh my God. Oh. Yeah. There's an extended sequence where Reggie talks about his tumultuous relationship with Billy Martin.
It's what not. What was his comment? One's a liar and the other's convicted.
Yep. Yep. But he doesn't pull any punches. Yeah. You know, when he's talking about this time, and which I think is great. Like that's like it's important because particularly when you think about like how Reggie's behavior and attitude were treated back then, and you compare that to the way the sport operates now, and it's like, you know, every team has multiple Reggie Jacksons.
Yeah,
you know?
But in those days, athletes of color were expected to behave in a certain way.
Yes. And it was great because we got some stuff, some old footage of Reggie's dad talking about, you know, what it meant to, you know, to be a man of color, like operating his own business. And he's like, you know, Reggie would tell the story. He's like, my dad was like, just, you know, do the work. You don't want to come back here and, you know, sew shirts for $60 a week. Like, you know, do what you have to do. But at the same time, it's like you said, it was all, you know, no one wanted to hear anything from these guys. It's just like, do your job on the field and we don't want to hear anything about it. And for these guys who were outspoken, and, you know, it's alluded to a couple of times, but it's like if you were a star, you could maybe get away with some stuff.
Right.
But I mean, if you're just like, you know, if you're rank and file, forget about it. Like you keep your mouth shut or they will, you know, they'll kick you to the curb just as soon as look at you. And so we go through the Yankee years and sort of the tail end of his career. But it was a really sort of interesting look at, you know, this guy who was this like huge iconoclast and like how the world has sort of like, I don't know, almost caught up to him in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
One of the things that it surprised me was the relative lack of ego in these talking head interviews, because again, like I don't, like all I have about Reggie Jackson is what I've read, you know, like, and the truth is like so many of the people who were writing about him, particularly in the time, they had their own biases. They had their own axes to grind. Yeah. And, you know, and he sort of bore the brunt of that in a lot of ways, you know, from, you know, the sort of mangled quote that got turned into the straw that stirs the drink. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the sort of the largely media generated antipathy that between Reggie and Thurman Munson, you know, like, and those two weren't best friends or anything like that, but I think the reality is, and you know, there was, you know, Reggie talked about it, and there was, you know, archival footage of Munson saying it too. It's like they respected each other's abilities as ball players, you know, and at a certain point, you don't have to, like, it's a workplace, you don't have to like everyone you work with, but you know, you respect them if they can do the job. And that was the thing. Like, say what you will about Reggie Jackson, dude could do the job.
563 career homers, 1,700 career RBIs, more strikeouts than anybody in the history of the game.
Attaboy.
2,597, but you never really lost it. I'm looking at the numbers here. At 39 years old, 27 homers, 85 RBIs. And even in his last season, he was 41 in 115 games, 15 homers, 43 runs batted in.
Yeah, like, I mean, he was someone who was able to get out on his own terms, which is pretty great. But yeah, you look in the strikeout numbers, obviously, like that was a thing that was so much more of a big deal, you know, 40 years ago than it is now. Like, you know,
the most he had was 171 in a season.
Right.
And that's nothing today.
Right. Well, like, what's his name? Reynolds, the dude who would strike out,
Mark Reynolds
would strike out 215 times a year.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like, you know, the game has changed, and the idea of a guy like Reggie, like in a three true outcomes era, like, I mean, like Reggie would have been an even bigger star than he was.
Absolutely.
You know, which is crazy to think about because he was huge.
Yeah, what service is this?
It's on Amazon Prime.
Man, I gotta watch that. It sounds great.
And it's a quick watch. It's like an hour 40 minutes, and like, it's just for like, oh man, just for the old uniforms and all the archival footage. Actually, that brings me to a point that I wanted to bring up before we stop. A lot of times when you watch old footage, it's like, oh, okay, like they clearly weren't as, you know, they weren't the same sorts of athletes or whatever. Like they didn't have the same sort of training regimens. Or you watch Reggie Jackson and it's like it's not like, oh yeah, if he had come up during, like, you know, with the proper training techniques and everything, it's like you could pluck 1969 Reggie Jackson, yeah, put him in a time machine, put him in, you know, in the cleanup spot for the Yankees today, and the dude would fit right in. I mean, absolutely, that swing was just magnificent. And they showed some clips of the real bombs that he would hit, like the one during the All-Star game,
Detroit 1971, boom.
And it's just like you see him hit it and it's like, oh wow, he got that one. And then the camera, and it's just like, holy crap. Like, yeah. I mean, that, like, I don't know, that it's just one of those things where it's like, as strong as these guys are today, like, I challenge any of them, Aaron, yeah, Judge, to hit a ball that far. Right. I dare you.
He'd be coming around third and the ball's still in the air.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just staggering. And it's just like, and the swing was sweet and clean. Oh, yeah. And just like, and that hasn't, like, you know, certain things translate over eras, and a swing like that absolutely does.
Well, I can't wait to see it. Reggie. Hey, thanks, Alan.
Hey, my pleasure.